This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Before we start Dreamland today, we're going to talk just very briefly for about 10 minutes to Bill Holman. Bill is the keeper of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. I meditated with Bill and the crystal skull a few days ago and found it to be an unusual and powerful experience. And to someone who meditates as much as I do and is frankly quite experienced in this process, that's saying something. So Saturday, tomorrow, my subscribers are going to be able to meditate with the crystal skull in the video room on unknowncountry.com at 11 a.m. Pacific time. So if you're a subscriber, show up and enjoy this extraordinary experience with us. And if you can't make it, we will leave it, the recording, on the subscriber video room as soon as it's finished. So don't worry about not being able to make it if you can't make it tomorrow. The recording will still be there. But try to do it live because it's a powerful experience. If you're not a subscriber, why not do it? Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe. There's nothing like this in the world. I can assure you of that. Bill, I think I'd like to start by asking you a simple and straightforward question. I meditated myself with Bill with the skull before, which is quite an extraordinary experience. At least it was for me. What is the skull?
Okay, well, the skull is, they say, is an embodiment of the knowledge of the universe has been programmed into it, is what I'm told. And it's a gift, more or less, if you ask the Mayans, from the gods. And it's here to help humanity at a time when the world needs help. And I think this is the time. We're at that time right now. So what it does is that it works on connecting with people's inner self. And it's very individual. You have, if you have 20 people there, each person is connected differently. And that's why everybody gets a different experience with it, too, because it goes into your subconscious self and kind of brings out what you have in there to more or less tie you to your higher consciousness. And the fact is that a lot of us live lives that are not connected to our real inner self. And to really be a full human being, to do what we're supposed to do here, we have to learn to listen to that inner voice and be connected to it. Well, the skull, easily or hard way of doing it, has the tendency to do that to people. But I find it quite interesting. But it also has a 90-degree turn in it, in the crystal, that helps in the meditation. I think you might have felt that, because when you go into the meditation with the skull, it takes you from third plane up to the fifth very, very easily and helps you facilitate a deeper and a more meaningful meditation in a lot of cases. So did you feel that when you were working with it?
Well, yeah, I didn't expect to, frankly, because I guess I'm too mired down in some other reality. But I didn't, let me put it this way. I didn't think it would do anything. I didn't think it would work. I thought it was just an interesting thing to do. And I'd never seen the actual Mitchell Hedges skull before. And I like Trish and Rob McGregor, who suggested we do this. But when I actually got into the meditation, I was quite surprised at the power of it. So, folks, we're having a little background noise in this darn thing. There's nothing I can do about it. The internet is not at its best now because of all of the high use, and hopefully most of that background noise that I'm hearing anyway will be gone when we filter this. But if not, please accept my apologies. Anyway, the meditation was quite powerful. And I, you know, I meditate a lot. I meditate 4 or 5 times a day and have been for 50 years. So when I say a meditation was unusually powerful, I'm saying something, frankly. So let me ask you this. Where did you come by this skull? How is it that you have it? Because it's a very famous skull. It must be worth a fortune.
Well, it's it cannot be sold. It can only be gifted. And that's how it was gifted to me. It was found in 1924 by a British explorer, F.A. Mitchell Hedges. And he was looking for a connection between Atlantis and the Maya. And he heard about this lost city down in British Honduras, which is now Belize, that there was this city that was, he was looking for, the White City. And so when he went down there with all his men and supplies, they did find the site of seven pyramids, ball courts, spiritual centers that was buried in the jungle. And when he uncovered all the pyramids, on the top of the tallest one, his adopted daughter Anna went to the top. And while she was up there, because the rocks had moved with the earthquakes and different things, the high noon sun made a big bright light. And so they started to open it up, and it took them, you know, to safely open it without it falling in. They got it up a small hole, and she was lowered into it, and she came out with the top of the skull. The skull is perfectly made in two pieces, and they determined that the top and the bottom is the same piece of crystal. It's perfectly separated somehow. So she had this skull, and she had it, it went back to her father, who had it till he passed away in 1959. In 1959, it went back to her, and she had it till she passed away in 2007. We became friends in the 80s, and she stayed with me the last part of her life, and she trained me on how to take care of it and what to do with it and the different secrets of it. And in that, it was my responsibility to carry on what she and her father started, which is to be able to bring the skull out to people in the world. Because, you know, if you took it to a museum, which she was thinking about too, they put it behind an inch thick glass and you don't really get to connect to it. But it's out where people can come and see it and feel the energy. Even when you do the meditations, there's an energy that comes through the Zoom room that you definitely feel it.
Definitely. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I felt it all right.
Yeah. In this day and age, there's very few things that are real. And when you find something like this, it's like, wow, there's something really here. But it's a gift to mankind to help them at this time. And it has a way of surrounding everyone with this light and bringing out your potential, because now is the time to create good things in the world. Now is the time to build a future with higher principles and higher acceptance of mankind as our brothers, and also working to realize that, hey, we have our spirit, which puts us in connection with God as a part of God. We are the creators. So it's very interesting. Yeah. And I do it because I really love it, and I love helping people and changing their life. It's a really, hey, if you got to do something, it's not a bad life to be able to see and change people and make them feel, you know, connected and better. It's pretty cool.
Well, especially in this day and time, it's a wonderful position to be in. And I'm so glad that you agreed to bring the skull on to unknowncountry.com. And now, folks, subscribers, we will record this meeting, and the recording will be, you'll be able to view the recording in the subscriber area. And for those of you who are subscribers, thank you so much for subscribing to Dreamland. And Bill, I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'm excited too. We're going to work on it together. Yep.
Right. Okay. Now we're moving into a really little known area: food, the visitors, the fairy folk, Bigfoot. What does that mean? There's food involved. People are given things to eat. I've had that experience. And then later, we're going down even deeper into some very mysterious childhood abductions, and not necessarily alien abductions. It's even weirder than that. a Trojan feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. And later, Thieves in the Night, a brief history of supernatural child abductions, which will curl your hair, guaranteed. But first, we're going to explore something that has been of intense interest to me for a long time. I have been in numerous times now in my life, but twice in my recorded history of my life, once in transformation and then in later in key, I was given a bitter liquid to drink. I have learned a lot about that liquid, and we'll discuss this with Joshua Cutchin in just a few minutes. But first, I would like to welcome Joshua to Dreamland, an unknown country, for the first time. Welcome, Joshua.
It is a pleasure and a privilege, Whitley. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, it's going to be an interesting show because we don't talk enough about this business of things ingested, and yet it's a very common feature of the close encounter experience, as it was of the fairy lore that came before. And as my listeners know, I regard the fairy, the alien lore as an outgrowth of the previous lore. And I wonder how you think about that.
Oh, I really couldn't agree more. It's become a bit of a meme amongst my friends and I that I'm sort of the therefore faithful guy. I for the longest time, I was really, I had those suspicions, building largely off of work from, you know, Jacques Vallée and some of your work as well. And I thought that the similarities were so striking that it really couldn't be denied. But then the more I looked, the more I became convinced that I can find an analog in abduction lore for something in fairy lore and vice versa. Even to the point of finding analogs for implants in fairy lore and, you know, analogs for the hybridization process in fairy lore as well. It's all very, very consistent. Now, having said that, I don't think that aliens are fairies, and I don't think that fairies are aliens. I think that they're both describing the same ineffable phenomena that we don't quite have our minds wrapped around just yet.
Well, there's something about it we definitely do not have our minds wrapped around. One of the issues being that it is a physical experience in some way, and yet not. And that gets me to this material, this, especially in my case, this white liquid that has been, it turned out to be quite a feature of my life with this unknown phenomenon. But before we go there, you passed quickly over the idea that hybridization and alien implants have something to do with the fairy lore. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, it's been pointed out by a lot of folks, including Graham Hancock, as well as, I believe, David Jacobs to a certain degree as well, about the similarities between alien changelings and the alien hybrid lore that we see in modern encounters. Beyond that, though, you can also find correspondence for things that we talk about in terms of the idea of the concept of star children, though these people are somehow spiritual hybrids of both extraterrestrials and humans. You find that analog in fairy lore as well, where many times these human fairy hybrids would be exceptionally gifted in the arts. They would be precocious, and they would, you know, it would be difficult, but they'll always be brilliant. And we find that exact same sort of comparison. Similarly, there's an interesting comparison to be made with some of these hybridization projects and the changeling lore, in the sense that not only do these changelings from fairy lore look quite a bit like these alien hybrids do, they're sickly and they're tired, but in the case of alien lore, many times you have, in the case of fairy lore rather, many times you have the actual human child who is whisked away to fairyland and a fairy child left in its place. And lots, many times in alien, for example, star child lore, you might find something similar conceptually with things like vanishing twin syndrome, where the twin who is dead is off with the star people and the one who has been left behind is left here on Earth. as far as alien implants go, this is what absolutely floored me, was this idea of the fairy blast. Etymologically speaking, the words blast, blister, and blustery all share the same Germanic root. And the idea came from the fact that it was believed that if you were hit with a fairy blast, which was a blustery wind, it would raise a blister. And inside that blister, if you had offended the fairies, you might find all manner of detritus, from bits of bone to bits of ceramic to bits of rock, feathers, hairs, all sorts of different things. And this is when I stopped and said, oh, that sounds strikingly like a lot of these implants, because, you know, a lot of these implants, when examined, at least to our current scientific knowledge, appear quite mundane. That's exactly what these fairy blast implants were describing as well, these mundane materials implanted underneath the skin. One that I found particularly interesting was from Newfoundland, I believe, where a lot of these Irish fairy beliefs got imported over. And this was an individual who had offended the fairy folk, and he had actually found a bit of what looked like string poking out of this fairy blast that he had. They pulled on it, it was this really irritating string that he had, and I thought that sounded strikingly like Morgellons disease, which, again, is something that's become folded into a lot of the ways that we talk about alien abduction and implants as well. So after I found that, I sat back and I said, I'm convinced that if you look hard enough, you can find an analog for, again, alien lore and fairy lore and fairy lore and alien lore. I think that it's too consistent to be ignored at this point, I think.
It's really different ways of looking at the same thing. I think that as our cultures advance and we became aware of outer space, which we were really not aware of in any significant way during the time of the fairy faith in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, then in the 19th century, we begin to search the skies. And in the 20th century, something really unusual happened. We had these terrible wars. And then in 1947, what had been very, very far under the surface in the culture sort of exploded into the UFO phenomenon. And how ironic that my own uncle was involved in the Roswell incident. And I know knew a man, he's dead now, who actually held the bodies in his arms. So, you know, it's not fiction. It's not as far as I'm concerned. And in addition to that, I've got this implant in my left ear, which when you started to talk about implants, turned on, which it does all the time, quite frequently. The fascinating thing about it was that it was x-rayed recently, and this is all described in my book, A New World, and it's not there, but it still works. Isn't that strange? I mean, what are we talking about here?
Well, I think that we have a real problem in Western culture of not realizing that there's a difference between imaginary and imaginal. And we have this, I think, sort of foolhardy false dichotomy of the physical versus the non-physical. And when you talk to anyone involved in ghost hunting or psi research, and it's very apparent that non-physical phenomena can leave physical effects on our world, on our reality. Anything from footprints to handprints to objects that are moved or, you know, spoons that are bent. So I really think we are dealing with a false dichotomy here. Things don't have to be as real as something that you can touch to also be simultaneously real, perhaps another layer of reality if you want to get really speculative. But I think that we need to wrestle with the idea that things can be non-physical and objectively real at the same time. That's not something that our current materials paradigm really wants to endorse, but at the same time, it's where the science seems to be going. If you're paying attention, it seems to be heading in that direction of something other than our current materialist worldview.
Dreamlanders, listen up and please help us. Don't just sit back and watch the website fade away, which it will happen. We are obviously all of us in a lot of trouble. And if you can afford to join this website, it's very well worth your time and your money. And we need you now. So go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab, do it. It will sure help.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh-Pasulka says, "Enter this risky new world and leave empowered." New York Times reporter Leslie Keene says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is Contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We're talking to Joshua Cutchin. His website, joshuacutchin.com. His new book, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. And then later we're going to be talking about Thieves in the Night, A Brief History of Supernatural Child Abductions. These books are very, very well worked out. I've read both of them, and they're absolutely fascinating because of the way they show the connection and the relationship between older ideas like the fairy faith and what's happening to us now. I think that Joshua and I probably differ a good bit about the level of physicality involved. I would say that the experience is very physical, but its foundations are different from ours in the sense that the physicality of it emerges out of reality in a different way than our physicality does, and this has caused a lot of confusion. But let's now go back to the substances, and we're going to start with the one that I've experienced the most, which I called the milk of Nepenthe, I called it that. I experienced that. There are two written records of it. One is in transformation when I was taken back or sent back from the experience. I was given a bitter white liquid to drink. And that same thing happened when the master of the key left my hotel room in Toronto in 1998. The first time I was more or less forced to drink it. The second time, incredibly, I just did it because he asked me to, and I've often thought to myself, why in the world would I have done that? But it seemed just like the most normal thing in the world at the time. I think that's probably because by that time I had done it many times. I just don't remember. Now, you said in your book, Joshua, that there was a homoerotic aspect to it that I ignored. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, things I never thought I'd be having to sit here and talk about with you. I suppose that you could imagine the idea of a male giving another male a milky substance as having some sort of perhaps semen-like appearance.
I see. I was very mystified by that. I didn't understand what you were getting at.
I was too oblique. My apologies.
No, that's okay. I just didn't understand it. I don't. I don't have much of an awareness of that. I only had one sex partner in my life, so I'm. I'm afraid I'm not asexual at all. But I've never had sex with a man.
And if sexuality wasn't baked into a lot of not just your experiences, but the experience with the other and the others so many times, I probably wouldn't have even occurred to me. But I feel like a lot of these experiences, given that so much of the characteristics do have a sexual component, you kind of have to look at it from that angle, even when it's not absolutely apparent.
Well, I think that sexuality is really an important factor in this. It certainly is in my own experience, especially recently. But the most powerful sexual experience I ever had was with one of these beings. And it's such an ultra-high strangeness experience. I've talked about it enough with my listeners. They know the story by heart, I'm sure, by now. But in recent years, there have been many instances in which I feel but cannot directly remember that there has been some kind of sexual contact. Do you find that? I mean, that's the extraction of semen from my body when in the first experience in 1985 into the second experience in 1985, the December experience, is just one example. And the taking of eggs and the taking of bodies, of babies and so forth. This is a profoundly sexual experience, in my opinion.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And that's something that you see, surprisingly enough, you see it, you know, not only in Fairy of Lore, but you also see it in Sasquatch stuff. I mean, about, you know, people being, young Native American maidens being taken by these things for breeding purposes. It's really
there's even a subculture of Sasquatch romance novels.
I'm familiar. Yeah, it's one of those aspects that really is baked into this experience, and I think that if we're paying attention, that's trying to tell us something. I don't know exactly what, but I don't think that. I mean, of course, you know, your work with Jeffrey Kripal would suggest as much as well. I know that he's very keyed into this aspect of the phenomena as well. But I think that it's giving us a hint as to exactly what's going on with that. I don't think we've completely decoded it, but I think that there is something that's transcendental in the act of sexual intercourse that, not to sound too much like a prude, but I think that our modern culture has really lost sight of that in many ways, in most ways. It's just this energetic transfer that is, really shouldn't be taken lightly.
Let's get back to this milky substance. And now that we've gotten past the idea that it might be semen, I hope, because I did not drink the Master of the Keys semen, I'm pretty sure a glass of it would have been quite a dramatic production. Let me put it that way.
It's going to be a world record, right?
Right, exactly. Anyway, I've thought a lot about it because I think it's something that may be more important in this experience than we realize, because I think we often forget that it was used. But as time has gone on, and I've had many, many more encounters with the visitors over the years, I'm beginning to remember it in some detail. And I've been studying it. And let me tell you exactly what it's like. It's very bitter. It's fairly thick. There's an undertaste in it of something vegetable that is like almost like cucumber. And it is, I think, the medium it's in is alcohol. I think it's the milk of poppies, not refined. Mm. And I think that I was looking in for this other flavor. I thought it was maybe mixed with cucumbers. However, in Latin literature, I believe it's Horace or it might be Pliny, says that he thinks that the mixture is made with borage. And oddly enough, borage tastes something like cucumber. So it could be that this is an ancient natural medicine that they still use to this day. I mean, here you have these unbelievable technological and capabilities, soaring spiritual knowledge, extraordinary depth of relationship, including all kinds of sexual relationship with us. And then you have a substance that is so primitive and yet so effective, because I'm telling you, it wipes your memory clean. It used to with me. It doesn't do that so much anymore, simply because I've had it so much, I think.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned borage, because the in a nice little synchronicity, I think borage is also known as starflower, which would kind of be a nice little
How odd. No, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I think that so what you experienced in terms of me researching a Trojan piece is something that I found a lot. Not only are liquids the things that both contactees and abductees, if we can use those sort of outdated terms, experience the most, but also they tend to bookend an encounter. So either it's the first thing that happens after they, you know, after they are taken, or it's the last thing that happens before they leave. Almost like it, I mean, you know, you say forgetting, and that's definitely something that you find in all the literature, that a lot of people have the sensation that whatever they're given, be it food or drink, sort of facilitates this this forgetfulness, the amnesia. But also, it also seems almost as if it somehow is tied into making the encounter kick off or shut down in some way. It's something that I found as well. And I find that really interesting if you view that through the lens of, you know, things like entheogens and psychedelic substances, not to say that this was that.
Well, it is a psychedelic substance. It certainly has a psychedelic effect. I mean, in the sense that it alters brain function, clearly.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's all about, I think it's directly tied into, from what I found, at least, it's directly tied into facilitating the experience in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a few minutes about MK Ultra also and its relationship to this. Free Dreamlanders, as always, I beg, I plead, you do little or nothing, but please, please do keep us going, because I love doing this and it's important. And if you look on the website and the free message boards, you'll find out how important, because there's some extraordinary things going on those message boards that aren't going on anywhere else on planet Earth, anywhere else. And that social group is unique on the planet. And it's important, and believe me, it has a resonance that is far beyond what anyone would imagine. So please help keep us going. And remember, there's a lot of free stuff. The newsletter is free. The message boards are free. The daily news is free. Most of Dreamland is free. I do my absolute best to make this as accessible as possible in the context of being able to continue. Help me continue. So go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab, do it. It will sure help.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on Earthfiles.com. Ever wonder what the close encounter experience is all about? Think you know what it's about? When you open Whitley and Ann Strieber's Immortal Communion Letters, you're going to experience a whole new vision, not something being told to us by researchers and theorists, but the actual testimony of people who came face to face with this unknown. Unforgettable. And the book is only $3.99 at Strieber.com.
We're talking to Joshua Cutchin. His website, joshuacutchin.com. His new book, A Trojan Feast, and then later, we're going to be talking about Thieves in the Night, A Brief History of Supernatural Child Abductions. And we'll have David Pilates on the show soon again, too, talking about disappearances. And David has been in the throes of moving to Oregon during the coronavirus lockdown. So hopefully we will hear from him again. I'm just going to send him an email very soon and see if we can do this. Anyway, you mentioned MK Ultra very briefly in your book, but I think it's not of central importance here in a way, but maybe it is. I remember in my book Transformation, I mentioned being given 3 drops of clear liquid on my tongue at one point. And this whole experience is so hallucinatory, and the hallucinations are all wrapped up in actual physical outcomes of various kinds. And do you think that it's possible that somebody behind the scenes might know a lot more about it and maybe even can use it to further some kind of peculiar hidden agenda about informing us of who we really are, or disinforming us about that?
I mean, I think absolutely. I mean, to the extent that I would probably even push back a little bit on on the term hallucination. I mean, just because you see something that isn't in our physical realm doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have, you know, a sort of objective experience or objective reality, rather. I think I mentioned MKUltra vis-a-vis the Orfeo Angelucci experience, but as far as the way that powers that be sort of having a knowledge of what these substances do and sort of gateways of the open, a problem that the modern scientific establishment, and it's getting better, it's getting a lot better, but the problem that the modern scientific establishment has with things like psychedelics is that they mistake the key for the room or the key for the door. A door is not a key. A door is not the room. It's not, and a key is not the room either. It's a way of gaining access to the room. So just because you might take a substance that might make you see things, that doesn't mean that those things are just, you know, are just a byproduct of the substance. There might actually be something tangible there. You know, I've theorized, being sort of a relatively ardent anti-extraterrestrial hypothesis guy, which, you know, I'm not militant about it, but I don't think it's the most parsimonious explanation. I've often wondered if the true secret that, you know, governments are hiding is not the proof of extraterrestrial life, but rather the proof that we are all immortal and that there is some sort of not only higher power, but some sort of spirit realm that that we eventually will have access to. Because if that's the case, then the governments of the world are no longer the primary authority. And the worst threat that they can give you, violence or death, really has no effect on your sovereignty as an immortal being. So sometimes I wonder if that's the big thing that's being kept under lock and key by governments. And they've sort of found this out by working with experiencers and working in projects like MKUltra and inducing altered states of consciousness and saying, oh, wait, this is actually real. And its reality undermines the very way that we've actually structured our power system.
Trying to use people to alter it and to alter their state in order to break through into another reality is what you're saying.
Yes.
I want to read you something from my dream book that I wrote last night. I am now living in two worlds. At night, I live out the life in the other reality during the day in this one. This is not a dream. It may be that I am about to pass from this life. Now, I have had, over the past few months, numerous experiences of actually being in another version of the world. These are not lucid dreams. I mean, I'm actually walking and down the streets of such a world, and it is a version of this world that is different in very profound ways, but it's exactly like what I described in New World, in the passage called The Fields of Asphodel, where I was at an Indian reservation in South Dakota, and when I closed my eyes, I was in one version of the area, and it opened them in another. So what you're saying here suggests, I think you might be right. I think that there might be another reality here, and that all of the secrecy is about trying to open a door between this reality and that one from our side, because it's clear, if this is true, the door from the other side is wide open. They come through it all the time, back and forth.
I mean, absolutely. And I think that if you look at what a lot of experiences, including people like yourself, have said, these experiences take place in some sort of realm that seems more real than our reality. I know Mike Columbus has said that, and you know, if there's this, again, this strange conflation that you find between you know, Tiernanog, fairyland, dreamland, appropriately enough, you know, as well as you know, the realm of the dead. I mean, one of my favorite medieval poems, it's sort of fragmented, but the Queen of Elfin's Nurse, and in the story, there are three paths after you pass away. One leads to heaven, one leads to hell, and one leads to fairyland. And there's a strong conflation, strong association with the fairy folk, especially in Western Europe. I don't mean to be monolithic about it, but a lot of the traditions are very, very much the same worldwide. But especially in Western Europe, there's this real conflation of the fairy folk with the dead, to the extent that sometimes it's impossible to tell if they are the dead or if they're conversing with the dead. But in a lot of these stories where people go to fairyland, they see dead relatives, dead friends, dead neighbors. And the thing that I always keep on coming back to is, you know, well, if fairies and aliens, what we call aliens, are so similar, and there's this connection between the fairies and the dead, and again, what, you know, Anne famously said about there being, this having to do with something, with whatever we call death, where does that leave us as people who are trying to get to the bottom of this? I think we have to start looking at things like, you know, ancestor worship and the dead and all these sort of afterlife spiritual components. I think that if you're intellectually honest and you follow the data, that's kind of the direction that's pointing at them.
Well, exactly. I think that there is a huge connection. And, you know, my listeners all know about the cabin experiences where the dead almost inevitably showed up along with the visitors. And in the letters that inspired Anne's comment, this was a commonplace aspect of it. And
it feels underreported, though, I feel like.
A lot of the UFO community has this, you know, they have a, there's a kind of a, I guess it's a folklore almost that these are aliens from another planet. The government is hiding. It needs to disclose the truth. If it did disclose the truth, then we would be able to experience and enjoy a wealth of new technology, and we would be free in a new, entirely new way. And they know that, and they're hiding that from us. This, and that the aliens are really wonderful beings. This is the Stephen Greer scenario. And it's a very popular scenario. It's similar to the Corey Good scenario, where the evil government is hiding something miraculous from us, and that miraculous thing is the presence of aliens. But how it's so, it doesn't work, and it doesn't work for the simple reason that if the aliens were here and they don't want to be hidden, they wouldn't be hidden. The government can't do anything about that. It's not hiding anything. Or if it is hiding something, then so are the visitors. They're hiding it too. Listen, we got to take another little break, folks. You know, always on Dreamland, you hear this from a different angle, a different point of view. Maybe it's not the most popular point of view, but it's the most interesting. And, you know, one thing I've learned in my life is popular does not mean true. In fact, it often means the opposite. We march to a different drummer here. We're not really sure what's going on, but we are more sure than any of the big popular guys that something is. We'll be right back.
As a subscriber of Dreamland for many years, it's been an incredible adventure and truly a Rosetta Stone for so many of the experiences that all of your listeners have had. Please join us. It's a fantastic ride. But I will say that certainly Dreamland does reflect something that I've always known, that man's mind mirrors a universe that mirrors man's mind. And no other place will you get this truth than on Dreamland. Come join us.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's Meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more. The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. As little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
I've been having a lot of trouble with my voice, and you don't hear it because I have to keep stopping on part of Joshua, and my nose is stopping up. All kinds of things are happening to me that are making it hard for me to deliver the show. I think this is because inside myself, there is a voice literally saying, shut up, don't talk about that. That's not that secret. We're talking to Joshua Cutchin about a Trojan feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. And we haven't gotten to Sasquatch yet, but we will. And I'm telling you, we're talking about mind-altering substances that keep us from understanding ourselves, who we are, where we are, and what we are. You talk about disclosure. Disclosure's not about paperwork that from some vault under some mountain. General Exon told me years and years ago that this stuff was so secret that they did not even put most of it down on paper. It's not written down. And he said to me in 1988 that as late as 1983, he was still going to regular meetings of the scientific group that works on this in order for them to tell him, for him to be able to tell him what they thought and did in the same meetings in the past, in the, up until 1963, when he stopped being a member of that group. So you talk about secret. This is really secret, and it's secret in me too. A Trojan feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. As you listen, it is literally opening a sesame inside of me. Before we started this show, I did not remember the formula for the milk of Nepenthe, but I do now. I remember it perfectly well. And I'm not only that, I know that I've drunk it many times. So in my life and now, the veil is falling. Does that mean I am about to die? It could very well be. Am I scared? Not at all. But I'm happy to say that if I do kick the bucket, you have this enormous archive that contains probably in one way or another many of the great secrets of the world. So, Joshua, we talked about MK Ultra and what they may really be hiding. Let's talk about who the fairy folk and the aliens might be, in your opinion. First, is there any realm in which they are physical, in your thought?
Well, again, I sort of return to the idea that yes and no. I mean, I think that we have sort of painted ourselves into a corner in terms of our philosophy in the West of things having to be physical or non-physical. I think that things can be both at the same time. I mean, if you look at, I think it was Terence McKinnon once said that, materialism is great for explaining, physical reactions to things. Like, if you take, drug X, you have experience Y, or if you, explaining the law of conservation of momentum and whatnot, that doesn't explain things like love affairs and, war campaigns. So I think that we have this really silly idea that things have to be one or the other. I mean, it's completely folly to deny that there is a strong physical component to this. I think it was John Mack who hypothesized that a lot of this could be basically a reified metaphor, the idea that somehow things like Jungian archetypes and like, these strong urges that we have, these strong mental constructs that we have are somehow manifesting in reality. I remain pretty agnostic onto the physicality or non-physicality of this sort of thing, other than to say that it definitely has a means of interacting with our physical world. As far as what these things may be, at the end of the day, I have taken the cue from my mentor Greg Bishop. I try to never let myself get too painted into a corner to use that metaphor again on any sort of single belief system. If you asked me in 2 months what I thought about this and I gave you the exact same answer, I'd be pretty disappointed in myself. Having said that, because I think that's a sign of someone who's, thinking in a healthy way and being self-critical and all that stuff. But, you know, having said that, I am really fond of a friend of mine, Gordon White, who would be a great person for you to talk to. He has often compared what's going on in terms of all these sort of paranormal, for lack of a better term, subjects, aliens, fairies, Sasquatch, all this stuff, as a sort of an ecosystem of spirits. And you have some... you have some good agents, then you have some bad agents, then you have some free agents in between who aren't really married to anything. Now, again, not saying spirits necessarily in that restrictive Judeo-Christian sense, but it's just in terms of discarnate entities that have the capability of becoming physical and interacting with our physical world. But the thing that I think was really interesting is if you look at a lot of these things, more so in probably in fairy lore than in terms of a lot of the contact experiences, the modern contact experiences that I found with extraterrestrials. But if you look at sort of the fairy lore, there's a lot of room for things that, again, to paraphrase Gordon, are sort of like sharks. You know, a shark isn't good or bad. It can easily end your life, but a shark is going to shark. You know, a shark's just going to be a shark.
Right, yeah. So we have, you know, these cartoons that Disney used to produce where the big bad, and we have fairy lore, of course, folklore about the big bad wolf, and the predator is evil because he does what he has to do to live. And the truth is, the predator is not evil. He's simply a predator, part of nature.
No, I mean, life thrives on death. I mean, that's just, even if you're a vegetarian, life thrives on death.
Right, and life ends in death. I think life is about death, frankly.
It's a dress rehearsal.
it's a matter of, you know, what are we, you know, everything lives a life and then dies. Everything. We have a difference in that we can see ourselves doing that. And the whole spiritual life of man rests on that. And these other beings look at us through eyes that reflect that. That's why they're so hard to look at. When you are with them, you see those eyes looking at you. They're not looking at your face. They're looking inside your face into who's really in there. And it's hard. It's very hard.
You know, I'm reminded, you know, as a Christian, I'm reminded of you know, the parts of the scripture that talk about, you know, sitting in judgment before God. And I wouldn't say everybody is, you know, who's made some mistakes, but everybody on the planet's like, ooh, that seems, you know, everything that I've done wrong, or every, you know, every thought that I've had laid bare is kind of painful. And that's what the experiences with the visitors always sound like, is that, like you said, they're looking into your soul, looking into their eyes, almost looks like you're falling into the abyss, is from what I've gathered. I'm not an experiencer myself, but that's what I've gathered. You know, I think that some people will probably push back on using the term spirit, and I don't necessarily mean that in terms that we would think. It's kind of a placeholder. I mean, if you really held my feet to the fire, I can't say that I really have any grasp of what's going on. I mean, by me saying spirit, I might mean, you know, physical manifestations of Jungian archetypes, which I think is still a fascinating idea in and of its own, that we as a collective species can generate that sort of momentum behind thought enough to bring it forward into matter. I think that's kind of fascinating in and of itself. So I guess what I'm saying is that if you think that this is purely physical, I think that you're incorrect. And if you think this is purely metaphysical and non-physical, I think you're also incorrect. I think it really does straddle that line.
Right.
Again, I know some people probably say that I'm sitting on the fence and I'm trying not to offend, but honestly, if you look at what people say, that's kind of where you wind up, if you're being honest, I think.
Right. And, you know, it's this ambiguity reflects nature itself. At the core of nature is indeterminacy. We know that from the double slit experiment and quantum indeterminacy. We know that the world is not fixed. Our brains filter it in such a way that it is fixed for us. But, you know, and so, of course, there's this ambiguity. I always say, whenever you're close to the truth, you're close to the unknown. And one of the teachers I had, Pamela Travers, P.L. Travers, used to say, to lie in the lap of the goddess means to be unsure. And I thought, and I think now, that is one of the most profound truths about our relationship with the sacred that there is, because we don't know and can't know absolutely. And you're talking to a guy whose family and now friends work on the materials and have expressed lots of advances into the culture working on these materials that came from crashed UFOs.
Oh, I totally think that the idea of the farther, well, to be sort of pithy about it, you know, the more you learn, the less you know. But I've always been really fond of this quote that that Terrence McKenna once said of, you know, having maturity to sit with the messiness of the mystery and to just sit with it and be like, it is, to use that word again, it's ineffable. You can't grasp it, and that very well, in some ways, might be, I think, the point, is that you are not being given answers, so therefore you have to turn inward to find those answers.
Right. It forces you to take an inner journey, a journey of self-exploration and exploration of the universe around you. It forces you. This is what it is. And, you know, people always say this is a school, and they're right. And this is how it works. These are how the classes work. Number one class in the school is hello? What is this? That's grade one, class one. Okay.
In my opinion, that's disclosure. You know, that's
right, disclosure. Right. Exactly. I agree with you totally. Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break. Beg, plead, you know what I mean. Subscribers, you know, I've had some extraordinary experiences lately. And when I had them, I wrote Jeffrey Kripal a letter about them. And I said, do not disclose this until after I die. But during the course of this show, there has been so much turmoil in my head about that. I am going to put it in the subscriber section in subscriber specials. I'm going to describe it in detail for you. So it's going to be there in the subscriber section. And if I do kick the bucket soon, and I don't expect to, by the way, I'm healthy as a horse. I don't have COVID. I'm under lockdown, going berserk in here. In fact, I'm a very physical person. I love to ride bikes and stuff, and they closed down all of the bikes that we weren't supposed to be riding, so we couldn't ride them anymore, the public bikes. I don't have my own bicycle. And so I'm sort of berserk, and perhaps that's why I'm going to do this. But I just have a feeling it's time somehow. I think we touched on something huge when we talked about MK Ultra and the possible real reason for the secret. Oh, what a great show this is. Joshua, thank you for coming on, and thank you for your insights. We'll be right back. The Afterlife Revolution is getting great reviews. There's a tremendous, lovely response to it, and I'm so pleased and humbled because it's an effort on the part of myself and Anne. And I love Anne so much. I want her to succeed in this incredible task that she has undertaken of returning and communicating across the bridge between the worlds. And she's really doing it. This is a real thing that's happening. Listen to some of these reviews. Anne and Whitley Strieber lay out their life's work in the most exquisitely beautiful manner. This moving book comes from the heart, the unified heart of two people who have dedicated their lives in this realm and the next to revealing the nature of consciousness as it makes its sojourn in this human form. That's just one. Here's another. I love this book. It's a wonderful read, especially if you lost somebody very close to you. Just incredible. Here's another one. The book shows you how to grow your soul, for lack of a better term. Through Anne's insight, Whitley shares invaluable information that could only be from the other side. So take it seriously. Go to Amazon and get Afterlife Revolution. Go on Amazon and get the Afterlife Revolution. It's available as a Kindle. It's available in KDB Select. It is available as a paperback and as an audiobook read by me. So enjoy the Afterlife Revolution now, especially. It's a beautiful way to spend some time in this period that we're in. It's extremely reassuring, a lovely experience to write, to experience, and to read. Okay, we're talking to Joshua Cutchin. His two books, A Trojan Feast and later Thieves in the Night. This is a very thoughtful writer and a very thoughtful man who is able to walk the tightrope. Very few of our guests can really do that. But Joshua, not only can he do it, I mean, they say, oh yeah, I walk the tightrope. But he does it with knowledge because he really is deep into this stuff and understands it profoundly. And now we're going on to food, fruit. Talk about physical. This book is full of descriptions of the most wonderful fairy food. And I want to just sort of blow the whole indeterminacy idea out of the water by talking about the April 12, 1980 landing on a farm in a Cuban prison and what the prisoners found.
Well, this was a story that I believe I found in Albert Rosales' Humanoid database, which is a great resource. And fortunately for Albert, he's taken it down and he's compiled it into discrete books. Unfortunately for the rest of us, that means that he's taken down all those old PDFs. But there was allegedly, according to this report, some bright lights that were seen in the Cuban prison and this shadowy figure that was lurking around. And they left behind this bizarre cornucopia of anomalous fruit. They were all oversized, and there were, I think, apples and oranges and either papayas or pineapple, I can't recall which, but one of the inmates claimed that he had an infected leg wound, which I'm sure, you know, if you're in a Cuban prison, they don't give you they don't give the prisoners.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a bad place to get an infected leg wound for sure.
But he claimed that after eating the fruit, he was healed, and that's something that you do see in a lot of these cases, is that some of these substances that are administered can have miraculous healing qualities. There was a similar case of healing from this young man who was in Brazil in, I believe, the late 80s. And he was surrounded by these little small men in uniforms with these dark green eyes and white skin and with light hair, and they had these wands. And they escorted him to a cave, and he also had a leg injury. And he was given something that resembled like a smooth red plum type thing. And he claimed to be confused and sort of pallid for a time afterwards, but the leg injury completely healed. So this is definitely something that you see, and obviously that ties in with a lot of religious folklore and mythological folklore worldwide.
So was the fruit there?
Well, you're going to hold my feet to the fire on this. I think it has to be. But at the same time, I will say that if you have an experience that is profound while trying a new flavor, or, you know, in my second book, The Brimstone Deceit, I sort of talk about this regarding smells as well. If you have a profound experience associated with a taste or a smell, that taste or smell can literally put you right back, not only in that memory, but in that emotional state as well. So if you wish to facilitate an emotion, and, you know, I think the evidence is clear that you can have miraculous healings from, you know, using mental capacity. If you want to put someone in a particular mental state, you don't necessarily even have to have a physical food there. You just have to sort of have that pageantry there, and it'll sort of make that same trigger. I think that you can't get around the physical aspects of this stuff. If you're looking to take a picture or to capture it and reverse engineer it, I don't know if that's always the most fruitful approach. Not say that it isn't ever, but I think that your time is probably better spent with more metaphysical pursuits. I think that's probably more consistent than taking the physical route.
I think that, you know, we took the physical route with my implant and actually did examine a little bit of it. And I have some material from that Linda Moulton Howe, lucky girl, sold her part of it to TTSA, the group that Lee Elizondo and Hal Puthoff are in, from some sort of strange material. I've got some of it too. It's a sort of foamed layered bismuth magnesium. She sold hers to them for $35,000, but they won't even talk to me. The only one of that whole group who will talk to me is Hal Puthoff, who has been a friend since forever. And so they didn't offer me any money for mine, and mine is still in my office. If anyone wants to offer me some money for it, I'll take $34,950 for it. In any case, let's go on now to another physical story, which comes right after the fruit one, interestingly enough. You made my show work for me so conveniently. A young woman named Irina from Yaroslavl, Russia, was awoken by a bright light streaming in through her window on the evening of February the 10th, 1997. A tall woman with white skin, black eyes, and long, straight black hair, compared to the Panama case above, which we didn't discuss, materialized saying, "I am Gelida from the planet Uta." Irina lost consciousness and awoke aboard an alien spacecraft where, among other things, she was given a lecture on how the negligence of Galita's people had destroyed their home world. Irina then passed out again, came to in a beautiful green meadow, presumably the new home world Galita's people had colonized. Can you go on with that story? And then, folks, I'm going to give you a brain bender about this story. I know something else about it. Tell us more of the story, though.
Well, I believe this comes from a book called Fourth Dimension and UFOs by a Russian researcher named Narcissov. And, these Russian stories are always really, really, they're always kind of wild in the best way. They always have these great, like, you know, proper nouns that sound like they were plucked from a 1950s or a Roger Corman film.
Right.
She woke in this new homeworld, this beautiful green meadow, which I would be remiss if I didn't draw some comparisons to sort of the pastoral appearance that Fairyland has in a lot of these older stories. She was supposedly with her dog, and they were running through this beautiful meadow, and they actually ended up feasting on these giant, again, this oversized fruit. These are giant strawberries. She describes them as strawberries. I doubt they were really strawberries, but describing them, these strawberries, sort of a meaty flesh, and this Galita lady invited Irina to try the fruit. She said it tasted like a strawberry pineapple sort of flavor, and the juice dribbled onto her dress, and when she looked down at the stain, she realized she was back home at her bed. Now, I'm not convinced that this wasn't a dream, but again, just throwing out that sort of imaginal doesn't mean imaginary sort of, warning. Because even though this might have been sort of something that happened in, you know, dreamland.
That's where we are now.
I keep on dropping that word. Even though this might have been something that happened in sort of the dream realm, according to this research, her doctor's visit revealed a high amount of, like, leukocytes and a low amount of lymphocytes in her blood, which is something that you see appear every now and then in certain literature about this topic.
What are the medical significance of that?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And if we can put this on pause for a minute, I'll tell you.
It's stress related?
It's about fighting off infection. Leukocytes are highly related to fighting off infection. So they're basically white blood cells.
Yeah, because you know I had a period where my body broke down when I was 7 years old because of stress from related to a program I was in at Randolph Air Force Base, I think.
This is sort of secret school era?
Yeah. And I wonder if there's no way to tell now, and they may not even been able to tell then. But, you know, always when I hear strange things about blood, I wonder, because I do know that it must have been my white blood count was very low. Anyway, and that can be stress related. And when you're stressing a little 7-year old child, like I was being stressed, that child is definitely headed for death if they don't back off, which they, thank God they did for me. Okay. Now we have come to the end of the first 2 hours of Dreamland, folks. And I will be frank with you. The subscribers are about to hear something really cool. Really cool. And Joshua and I are going to have a lot of fun with it. It is about that lady with the long black hair and something that happened in 1988 and was reported on Dreamland in 2005. And if you were a subscriber, you could listen to that show in 2005. And I think that when you compared it to this show, it would revolutionize your thinking in a whole new way. Free Dreamlanders, I love you, and I'm so glad you come to the show. Subscribers, fasten your seatbelts. We're going for a really interesting ride. And then when that's over, we're going to be talking about children disappearing, because that is a huge meme in human life that we just almost don't want to look at. But Joshua looked at it with the clear eyes of a guy who knows how to walk the tightrope, and you can't really do this without doing that. Joshua Cutchin's website is joshuacutchin.com. His books, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch, Thieves in the Night, A Brief History of Supernatural Child Abductions, which is pretty thick for a brief history. Joshua, what are you working on now, just before we go?
Within the month, probably, knock on wood, I should be having my first of 2 volumes with my co-author Timothy Renner coming out about exclusively about Bigfoot, called Where the Footprints End. It's all about high strangeness in regards to Bigfoot sightings.
Great. We didn't address Bigfoot in the show, but we will, and that's great, because now we'll have Joshua back to address Bigfoot when his new book comes out, and I think I maybe have my brother read it too. My brother is obsessed with Bigfoot, and my brother's a terribly interesting guy, and he's a lawyer, but that does not mean he's dull by any means. He's one of the most fascinating people I know, and he should have been on this show more often. And we're going to have him from time to time now as well, as long as he's willing to do it. Okay, Free Dreamlanders, thank you for being with us as always. We'll talk to you again next week with something else. Who knows what?
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.